involvement.
Okay, and that's why you came here as well, because when you graduated from here,
yeah,
were you looking for something in the Merchant Marine, or were you looking somewhere in like one of those private companies that you had brought here with Propeller Club?
There was, well, the only relationship that the Propeller Club had was that relative to where I wanted to go into a vocation was in Matson Navigation. There was a fellow named Hugh Gallagher who was a higher level executive in Matson, and I believe we asked him to come speak to us once, and I wanted to go to work for Matson. But when we were here, practically everyone was in the Naval Reserve, and upon graduation, went on active duty. There were two members of our class who had prior military experience, so they weren't required to do that. But almost everybody else had to do that.
Okay, and when you graduated, you were put into this active duty. Where did they send you?
Yeah, well, we were commissioned as ensigns and went on active duty. I was assigned, after a 10-week damage control school, I was assigned to the aircraft carrier Yorktown, where I was Boiler Division Junior Officer for about a year and Repair Officer for about a year. So my experience, the combination of my experience here at sea and the combination of my experience on the Yorktown for 2 years at sea, I decided I didn't want to be at sea anymore. So at that point, I applied to a number of different companies in the engineered products field, ended up getting a job as a sales engineer for a company from the Midwest.
Okay. And back to life being here on campus, we saw through the hosepipe there were a few dances. I mean, granted, this place back then, it was just primarily a bunch of guys. Was there a school nearby where you guys would truck out and you would meet for these dances, or?
Yeah, we would have get-togethers with a number of the college that I remember is Mills College in Oakland. We had a number of opportunities to spend time with them. I wish I had a better recollection of the other places we went, but Mills was the one that remains in my memory.
Yeah, let's see. I'm sorry, I'm trying to see what else there is, because it seems like we've covered quite a bit here.
Good.
I see. So when you did graduate from here, you were required to do some sort of service?
Military career?
Yeah.
2 years. And then there was a reserve obligation, but since it was designed for Merchant Marine, the assumption was that you wouldn't be able to go to meetings, wouldn't be able to have annual things in order to keep your activity level in the reserves. So we were in the reserves, but they just wrote us letters every once in a while and would throw them away if you wanted to, because it didn't bother you very much.
Okay, so you were required to do it, but you didn't have to do it for the
full...
No,
you couldn't. I'm not sure what their intent was. It may be that they wanted to do it by correspondence. I really can't remember. All I knew was that you didn't really have to worry about them because there was no downside risk. So you did do 2 years, and then that was pretty much it. I can remember getting a letter from them after about 8 years saying that you've been discharged from your reserve commission.
Okay, and then that's when you started applying to the engineering companies?
No, I was on the in the Navy just for just 2 years, but then we had some sort of an obligator for the
reserve.
For the reserves, yeah. The intent was that the school graduated individuals who had some training in naval science, and they were then prepared to be a naval officer. And we spent 2 years as a naval officer, but they felt, I believe, that in the event of an emergency, you need merchant ships as much as Navy ships. So it's sort of silly to train someone to be a merchant mariner and then use him as a naval officer, whereas you could go find another naval officer who didn't have the merchant marine experience.
Okay. But, I know it seems like going back and forth on this, but I just wanted
sure.
to be sure on that. So, when you did graduate from here, you weren't looking into anything of a military career, but you had to fulfill this obligation as some sort of a full graduation requirement?
In order to get the subsidy from MARAD, you had to have applied for a Merchant Marine, a Naval Reserve commission.
Oh, so this is actually to fully go through the whole MARAD program and...
That justified them providing the subsidy.
Okay.
Yeah, but of the 40... No, I should go back, going back to when we came in 1953 and when we graduated in 1956, I think it's important to note that 85 people arrived here in August of 53. And by the time that we came back from the Christmas break, it was down to 41. So it went from 85 to 41 in a period of 4 months. And
not surprising.
These people found out that they didn't really want to be here, so they didn't come back after Christmas break.
Same thing happened my freshman year. We had like 200 people leave. It was like,
yeah. Eesh.
So from that point on, just like, did the class get any bigger?
We lost one person. Martin First flunked out after the full first year. So then we were at 40, and we graduated 40. So of the 40, as I mentioned, most of them went in the Navy for 2 years. And Jim Durst and Harry McCullough didn't have to go in because they had prior they weren't part of the reserve program because they'd already fulfilled that. They probably got some payment from the armed services for their prior experience. I'm not sure. But somehow were able to get through the 3 years of financially, and they didn't have to go in the Navy. We did. So of the 40 who graduated, probably 38 went into the Navy for active duty. And of those, 12 stayed in the Navy. And of the 12, 5 made captain. So they were very successful.
Hmm. And did the success rate, I mean, not just graduation, but I mean job placement, was that as high back then as we're saying it is now?
Yes. We had job interviews. People came to campus and interviewed us. Even though we were going in the Navy for a couple of years, they were still interviewing. And of course, some of us didn't have to go into the Navy. So there were job interviews with offers. And now, of course, we're talking 1956 dollars. The offers were in the $400 range, $370, $400. Just multiply everything by 10 to get the current pricing. But we had to go in the Navy, which paid a couple hundred bucks a month. So that's what you did.
Okay, so in terms of finances, if you made it through 3 years of hell around here, then you were basically set if you'd done everything you were supposed to.
Well, you had the opportunity to go into a number of different fields. The cost of education, my cost for 3 years was $2,500. And all the other costs were either the subsidy from MARAD or, and the relatively low cost of education. I mean, education has gone up immensely compared to the rest of pricing. But anyway, if you look at the cost of the education, which, as I said, was $2,500, you got that money back, that investment back, within a few years, probably 2 years. You weren't getting much return on your investment in the Navy, but the minute you got out of the Navy and went into any sort of a commercial opportunity, you began earning enough money that you could pay that off if you had borrowed it.
Okay, and speaking of your tuition, what were some of the classes that you were required to take around here?
Well, what you the difference between then and now is that if you look at the class of 1956 engineers, of which I think we may have graduated 22, or the class of 1956 DEC, which graduated, I think, 18, every one of those individuals in the engineering discipline had the same courses in the same classroom each day. Same thing for the DEC. There were no minors, there was no choice of electives, so you went through in lockstep with the other individuals in your class.
Okay, were there any memorable teachers that you had? You know, anyone that sticks out because they were either really good at what they did or just like, I can't believe I got this. Oh.
Well, if you look at the dynamic of personalities, you'll find that you've got the students, the faculties, and the administration. The students and the faculty got along fairly well. Our enemy, of course, was the administration. And in those days, we had a lot of time to make trouble for the administration.
How so?
Well, different things. I didn't do all of them, but there were some memorable occasions. I remember that the superintendent at that time, whose name was Russell Eyrig, was picked up every morning from his quarters up above by the gardener. And the gardener drove this 1938 Chevy four-door up to pick up the admiral or the superintendent and bring him down here. So one morning they found they couldn't get it to start because someone had taken the rotor out of the distributor. So he had to go get the admiral in his gardener's pickup truck. So that was the sort of thing you could do and get away with. There's no way to trace that back.
Yeah. And were there actually staff houses up on that hill at the time?
Just the ones that are here now. I think there were five houses up there.
And this included the captain's house that you said where you kept your civilians?
No. The captain's house was at the entry to the school.
Ah.
That entry gate was followed by the captain's house.
Okay.
Right at that area. And I don't know that it was used for anything other. It may have had some administrative function. All I remember is that they were lockers in the basement for civilian clothes. But yeah, I think there were the chief engineer, I believe, had his house up at the faculty row, along with the superintendent and probably three others.
Huh.
Yeah, I think the commandant of midshipmen, fellow by the name of Heron, had his quarters up there. So at least the chief engineer, the superintendent, and the commandant.
Okay. And what was the structure like around here? Because I'm seeing in the hawsepipe, they called you either ensigns or petty officers.
That was not used particularly, other than to identify. I don't remember the use of the word ensign, but there was the corps commander, and there were division commanders, and then there were division petty officers. So out of 125 people, you'd have one corps commander, perhaps an adjutant, and that may have been that entire level of corps commander in that, like, number two band. And then you had the five division or company commanders, and then the rest of them were petty officers.
And what was your rank within your division?
I was a second-class petty officer. I was not particularly highly rated in leadership.
Right, but what were the duties you would perform as that?
Say again?
What were the duties you performed as that?
Practically nothing. I mean,
it was just there as a rank.
Well, I think basically you had to have some sort of a title. I don't know that it had any particular value. The people that had value were the company commander, the adjutant, and then the battalion commander, the adjutant, and the company commanders. They had some responsibility.
Okay. And you were just the guy that stood there to make them look more official?
I don't think that we really had too much concern about that aspect of it. I mean, at least I didn't. There may have been some people who aspired to rank, but I did not.
Just did it because it seemed good at the time?
Did it seem what?
Did it seem like a good idea at the time? You know, just like grab like some sort of ranking within your division?
Well, those ranks were assigned by the administration. So it was not a popularity contest, and there was no particular way for you to get to where you're going, to aspire to that, other than demonstrating some leadership ability, I assume.
Hmm.
But it was something that was a little concern to me.
All right. Also saw through the various other activities on this campus, there used to be a rifle club here. I mean, did you ever partake in that, or did you have to be a member of that club in order to actually do
I don't
anything?
Remember, there may have been, I don't remember anything in the way of a competitive rifle club. Most of us were issued a rifle, and you had to bring your rifle when they had a dress assembly once in a while. You had to bring your rifle. And
did they actually work, or were these
disarmed? I think so, but I didn't have one because, as I mentioned, I was in the band company. One of the advantages of being in the band company is you didn't have to have a rifle. So I didn't have a rifle.
And did they actually call you band company because you guys actually were a band? I mean, did you guys actually
Well,
play
when I arrived here, there was a band, and I played clarinet. But over the period that I was here, it sort of disintegrated, and we ended up having a bass drum and a snare drum and a bugle. And I don't remember which of those I played, but it wasn't the bugle, so maybe I played the bass drum. But we were still the band company, and we didn't have to have a rifle.
Did the guy who played the bugle ever have to get up and play reveille for everyone?
My roommate, Ralph Brown, was the bugler, and Ralph would get up every morning and play the reveille. And some other folks would get up and throw pebbles at him. So that's what you did in the morning, was throw pebbles at Ralph.
Did he also have to play taps for them?
He also played taps. We didn't throw pebbles at him for taps.
You were too tired to throw pebbles at
him. Well,
no.
I can't remember what time taps was sounded, but there was lights out. I think lights out at 10. Hmm. And, of course, no one, that was not religiously supervised, except by the spontaneous desire on the part of the duty officer to go through and make sure that all the lights were out, which meant the minute he left, I guess maybe the duty officer stayed in the captain's house, right? So anyway, when he came through the barracks, the messenger would immediately call the minute he left the captain's house, heading for the first barracks, and say, duty officer's coming, so the lights would go out.
How were watches done back then? Because the way it is here now, it's the Global Studies of Business Majors. When you came through that front gate,
right,
you saw them up there. We're normally up there, and then as you move up, we're down in the leadership building. It's just down by the waterfront, by the ship.
Uh-huh.
And we have the campus duty officer, their assistant campus duty officer, and we check up on those guys up there, and we'll do rounds around the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it was just the engineering and deck majors, how was watch performed around the campus back then?
Well, there was, to my remembrance, there was an individual, I don't think it made any difference whether he was deck or engine, but you were assigned to the watch at the entry. There was someone there 24 hours a day. Well, I'm not sure about 24 hours a day. There was someone there overnight. Then during the day, there was a watch standing in the administration building. There was an individual who was assigned to, I don't know whether we answered the telephone or not, but you had a watch there. So on campus, I believe there was a watch at the entry during the night, and during the day there was a watch in the administrative building. I can't remember whether or not there was a watch on the quarter deck during the time that the ship was in port. I vaguely think there was. Yes, I know there was, because I can remember standing the watch on the quarter deck early in the time that I was here. And I remember looking at the temperature gauge, and it said it was 38 degrees, which I thought was insanely cold for a young man from San Diego. 38 degrees was unacceptable, so thank goodness we had these nice warm pea coats.
And did the people on watch, did they also carry rifles with them?
No. Rifles were just for the
get-together.
Yeah, just for the time when you had your rifle. And it was a dress blues inspection with your rifle, you know.
And so they had your uniforms at the time. You'd mentioned you had your dungarees?
Dungarees. Like Levi's today.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had your dress blues.
Yeah.
Did you wear salt and peppers?
Well, I think of it in terms of khakis. During the time that you were in class, the morning time period, you wore khakis. And it was washed and starched khakis, and you wore them for a week, and at the end of that you got another pair, and you had to force your legs through the pants because they were so heavily starched. So the mornings during the week were khakis, and the afternoon were what I call dungarees. The only time you had the dress blues was for an inspection, or if there was a formal event, you'd wear your dress blues.
And were the grooming standards just as restricted back then? I mean, I know it's like these days, like no sideburns or anything, but it's like, did they have like anything out against facial hair at all times, like no mustaches even?
I never remember anyone having a beard or a mustache, and we had barbers. We had barbers who were part of the student body. I don't believe there may have been a barber on campus. I can't remember that, but there may have been. I know that there were student barbers.
Okay, and were these guys are just like, I mean, were there a lot of on-campus jobs?
Not too many. I don't remember any. I was able to get a job up in Vallejo on the weekends as I later, in the later times that I was here when I was a senior, in some sort of a office supply operation in a warehouse. But I don't remember any on campus jobs.
Okay. What were some of the best things that you could say that you actually took with you from this place?
Well, the awareness of mechanical concepts, both theory and practical. As I've described it, in the morning you would draw a valve, a cross-section of a valve, and in the afternoon you would disassemble a valve, put packing in the valve, reassemble it, and then energize it with some steam. If it leaked, you did it incorrectly, and you could do it again until you learned it. So the practical application of theory is what was going on here. And you had the theory in the morning and the application of the theory in the afternoon. And that has a lot of value because it's something that you will remember.
And were there any professors that were, let's see, what's the best way to put it? I guess there's not really no way to sugarcoat it, but were there any professors that you felt like they actually knew what they were talking about, or it's like, my God, I'm barely a first year, but I can do this guy's job better than he can?
Well, I had more math and science in high school than I had here, so that's always a little tough to, but it made life easy. The rigors of academia were not very rigorous. We had only one instructor, I believe, who had any education training, and that was a fellow named Noel Martin. He taught English, and I believe that was our only liberal arts course
in just 3 years.
English. And it was called Factual Communications. That was the course. And I think that might have been the name of the text. And the first assignment was write a 500-word set of instructions. Now, that sounds pretty easy to do, right? Until you try to distill a set of instructions into 500 words. I was interested in photography, so I thought, no problem. I'll describe how to make an enlargement. So I wasted my 500 words, and I still hadn't got the negative any further than in the negative holder. And so the most successful individual there was, I think, Dave Hartshorn. He did his 500-word set of instructions on how to shave.
500 words on how to shave.
How to shave. Well, you try to distill a set of instructions into 500 words, it's tough.
So I just find it amazing someone can actually do it on how to shave.
Why not? You know the subject?
Well, I'm just saying, it seems pretty run down and easy. Wash face.
No.
Apply shaving cream.
Right.
Apply razor. Don't cut yourself.
Oh, well, yeah, but what kind of razor?
Well, this is true. Did you guys back then just have the straight blades?
I had an electric razor, but most people had what we'd call safety razors. No one had a straight blade, straight edge. No one had a dangerous razor blade.
No one was willing to risk their own necks with that?
I never saw a person with a razor like that.
All right, and you just applied, and you just used a regular
razor? Oh, yeah, much easier to use a Norelco or a thing of Ronson or something like that. You had to plug it in, shave, and you were done.
And what was that? I mean, earlier you were saying you were talking about the barracks being around here, so what was housing like within these barracks? I mean, how were those laid out? I mean, how many people could you normally fit in those?
Well, when we arrived, we were four to the room. And after we were reduced in ranks, it came two to the room. And then there was some shuffling, and we ended up with three in the room. But most people shared a room with a roommate. And in those rooms, there were two bunk beds, 2 foot lockers, or I guess 4 foot lockers somehow, and some sort of a vertical locker. Then there was a central hallway which led to the common lavatory, showers and wash basins, and the commodes were at the end of the hall. And I would guess there must have been maybe 20 rooms, 10 on each side of the hall, for a total of maybe 40 people or 20 people.
And you had A barracks, B barracks, C barracks,
right.
Then the
band, I think. Band barracks, sort of a smaller barracks.
Sort of smaller.
And then the ship.
And then the ship. And did many people stay on the ship, or was the ship just parked there, used for classes, and then being taken out, and everyone stayed on campus?
There was ship's company. I mean, there was, I think, maybe D company, whatever it was, on the ship. And I don't know. That's right. If you were on the ship's if you were on the company that was aboard the ship, I think you stayed there for the full 3 years.
Oh, so there was no actual like rotation of people.
I don't remember any rotation.
Okay.
But when you went to sea, everybody was then reassigned to various berthing areas.
And what would you feel was like one of the best areas to be assigned to live on?
The ship had the best opportunity because you had more advance warning as to where the duty officer was, because the duty officer started up at the captain's house and ended up at the ship. So, but the ship had lots of prior warning.
How so?
Well, they called ahead. The messenger would call down and say where the duty officer was. So the battalion the duty officer got to the ship, everybody knew he was coming.
Hmm. Well, what about when you were on cruise and these guys were walking around inspecting things? Was there any way of knowing someone was on their way?
Well, on cruise, you have a routine that's so regimented that you don't really... you go on watch for 4 hours, and then you either sleep or do something else for 8 hours, and then you go back on watch. So it's just around the clock. So the supervision essentially was from the watch officer, the engineer, whoever would be responsible when you were on watch. But the supervision essentially was the first classman supervised the second classman who supervised the third classman.
Okay, so there were no surprise inspections or anything like that?
No. You had to have an inspection before you went ashore, and all the portholes had to be shined, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we had to do. They used us to clean up the ship and paint over any signs of rust and age.
Right. Rust never sleeps.
No, it doesn't. Ew. Yeah. Let's see. What were some of the standard watch performances you would do while out on cruise? I mean, were you often down just in the engine room?
Yeah, the technology has changed immensely. And this is not just the training ship. The industry today has large, slow-speed internal combustion engines using diesel fuel. Uh-huh. That is the standard for the merchant marine. When we were here, the ship was somewhat like the merchant fleet in that it had boilers and turbines. And today, you have no boilers. That being the boiler being an external combustion process and not as efficient. In the days before the large slow-speed diesel engine, which is an extremely efficient way of converting chemical energy into mechanical energy, we used a boiler. And I think the boiler had the advantage that you could use any fuel. Early on, they used coal. Probably before that, they used wood, but they ended up using fuel oil. So the ship has a boiler, and in this particular case, the training ship had fuel oil, fuel boiler.
I was actually almost going to ask you if they ever had you down there, you had to shovel coal into.
No, there was no coal. I don't believe any of the ships were coal burning. It may be that the first ship was a coal burner, but certainly every ship, the first bear and the second bear were external combustion systems. Steam turbine, and then some methodology to get into the shaft, and then the current ship has internal combustion engine. But because it had, you asked about the routine, because it was a boiler turbine ship, steam turbine ship, you had an individual responsible for keeping the fire going in the boiler. He was called a fireman. And there were usually two of those people. And in order to make the combustion process work properly, you had to change the burners very infrequently. And the burners had to be disassembled and reassembled and put back into the boiler. Then at the next level up, there was a fellow who was called an oiler. And he was just sort of a general checkout kind of guy, look at instrumentation, that sort of thing. And then the senior person in the engine room was the watchstander. He was the engineer. So there were those three, which meant as a third classman, you were a fireman, as a second classman, you were an oiler, and as a first classman, you were the watchstander. You were the engineer on watch. And those people went through the entire time they were here in the same system. That is, I was assigned to a watchstander